Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, here on New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies today, with our guest coming to us from Providence, Rhode Island. He is Professor Fabrizio Fenghi, an assistant professor of Slavic studies at Brown University, specializing in contemporary Russian culture and politics. Welcome, Fabrizio. Thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Stephen, for having me, and hi, everyone, to the audience.
So for our audience, this book is really wonderful. It's a book called It Will Be Fun and Terrifying, Nationalism and Protest in Post-Soviet Russia, published by University of Wisconsin Press, 2020. A little bit about Dr. Fenghi. He is an assistant professor of Slavic studies at Brown. And his interests include the relationship between art and literature and the shaping of post-Soviet public culture. Fenghi received his PhD in Slavic languages and lit from Yale in 2016, and he grew up in Milan, Italy, where he received his degrees in foreign languages and literatures from Milan State University. He spent several years of study and doing research in Moscow, where he was affiliated with the Russian State University for the Humanities, and Moscow State University. I'm particularly interested in this book because he studies the ways in which aesthetics and culture of the National Bolshevik Party of Edward Limonov, a radical countercultural movement, has influenced the development of Russian protest culture and the formation of state ideology during the Putin era. I have a lot of questions for Dr. Fenghi, who teaches courses on 20th and 21st century Russian culture, literature, and politics, Russian language, gender and sexuality, nationalism, and a whole lot more. So let's get started right away with the book, Fabrizio. I want to begin with the question that I always ask my interviewees, and that's how you came to the topic. So do you have an origin story intellectually and personally for what led you into the world of Moscow and Russian postmodernist literature?
Yes, of course. Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for the question. So the interest in Russian literature and Russian contemporary and post-Soviet literature more generally goes back to my college and master's years in Milan. But going kind of closer to the project for the book. My interest in sort of the beginning or the spark that kind of inspired the project was. In 2011 and 2012, on that sort of academic year, I was living in Moscow, working and studying. And this was before I had chosen the actual, so I was already a graduate student at Yale, but at that point living in Moscow. And I found myself in a quite vibrant, exciting, a little bit unexpected and unpredictable situation, which was this wave of protest for fair elections. That was kind of the main biggest sort of mass protest movements before these very recent events that we had with Navalny's arrest. And it was quite kind of a little bit of an epiphany for me, because I had already spent quite a bit of time in Russia and had interacted with Russians often. And the general feeling was that in previous years, I had been one of general sort of disengagement and political passivity and even fear to talk about politics, or a certain sort of uneasiness in talking about politics. And all of a sudden, this kind of 2011-12 moment was a moment in which 60 to 100,000 people would show up at mass protests. There were these famous kind of popular strolls led by writers, this Occupy by, kind of inspired by the Occupy Wall Street, but with a specific Russian flavor. And I was in the middle of all of this, and I started being more and more interested in not just literature or the arts, but their connection with politics. And at that point, the choice of Limonov and the National Bolshevik Party, which was quite gradual starting from there, was kind of not the most natural choice, because at that point, Limonov was not very much on board with the wave of protest. Edward Limonov was a kind of scandalous writer, the leader of the National Bolshevik Party. And he was quite a celebrity still in 2011 and 12. Right. He actually died last year. But he was also kind of not very much on board with these protests. And he kind of criticized them for being too bourgeois, too Westerners. He kind of reclaimed a sort of primacy on Russian protest culture, saying, well, the actual pioneers of post-Soviet protest culture, it was us in the sense of the National Bolsheviks. I had heard of the Natsboli. I knew of Limonov as a kind of underground emigre writer. I knew about the Natsboli, but they remained kind of a little bit of a mystery to me. And so I kind of, the choice of Limonov and the GNBP was a little bit of a knight's gambit. So not the most
that's interesting.
straightforward
yeah.
way to
yeah,
go
yeah.
at it, given that the latest movement was kind of not necessarily primarily led by him. So that's
really interesting. It's interesting, Fabrizio, that you begin the story in that moment in 2011. I wonder if I could ask you a little bit about the 1990s and 2000s going forward. And as you argue in the book, how countercultural movements get incorporated into and perhaps even co-opted into the political mainstream. Now, I mean, our listeners, I'm sure, will want to know about Dugin. It's sort of like the magic name and the magic word. Mm-hmm. But how do you set up in the book the story of the Natsboli and Limonov and Limonka? Are there antecedents to this kind of performative culture, or how do you understand the emergence after 2011 of his work?
Of course, yes. Actually, thank you for your question, and I think I'm really happy that you are looking at this as a historian in this sense, because I think that it's very important to have a quite rigorous periodization in the sense of the post-Soviet society and post-Soviet political culture, because, as you mentioned, the 1990s were a very different situation in terms of the sort of meaning of various political movements and ideologies. And so the NBP in particular emerges in this moment that is very different from the one of the first decade of the 2000s, that is this the kind of crucial key moment that precedes the foundation of the NBP is the parliamentary crisis of 1993, when this coalition of leftist and nationalist forces kind of starts resistance against the liberal, or especially sort of the kind of shock therapy and market, free market reforms of Yeltsin, and that resulted in that sort of violent, quite dramatic standoff, which ended with the bombing of the parliament and sort of also the killing of several hundred people, right? So it was this moment, and politically, right, this moment was one of kind of very different from the Putin era, in the sense that Yeltsin sort of, this was a moment in which, at least in words, liberal democracy and liberalism and sort of a sense of normalization and transition to democracy were kind of the dominant slogans and dominant words in Russian sort of mainstream media and society. And so the fact is that Limonov at that point was kind of coming back from his sort of emigre period, and the NBP was founded as this kind of radical rejection of everything that was mainstream and sort of accepted as a sort of end of history and end of ideology. And it was started by Limonov and by Alexander Dugin, who at that point was kind of much more of a fringe kind of figure. Some of my informants said that they kind of saw him as a sort of artist philosopher, so to speak. And the kind of goal of the NBP was to combine the radical right and nationalism with the radical left and communism, so kind of reclaim with this label, right, brand of red-brown ideology, which at the time was very much kind of a Krasnokorichneva Chuma, was kind of a very red-brown flag, was kind of much of a kind of a derogatory term. So they kind of reclaimed they were basically saying, we are the plague, we are the kind of Chuma, this horrible kind of unsavory characters. And the NBP started sort of, it was thought of as a political party, as a political movement, but it actually had many faces. It evolved in many very different ways. And it was at the same time more than a political party, kind of a countercultural movement, punk movement, an art movement in the sense of this bunker that was their central headquarters. So it had very different identities throughout the years, but this was the sort of beginning in terms of the ideology and sort of the historical situation that sparked the movement itself.
I'm particularly interested in how you set up your chapters around these counterculturalist critics and understand this as a criticism of postmodernity as well as what might be called neoliberalism. It's curious to me how you've arranged your chapters, and I wonder if you could introduce our readers to that, because I mean there are so many intellectual influences for Limonka. They have, you know, everyone from Guy Debord to like Marcuse and you know William Burroughs, and they stylize themselves in a particular way. So really, my question, borrowing from the title of one of your chapters called "Making Post-Soviet Counter Republics," is how you decided to arrange all of your materials and with sources and your informants, as you mentioned. Could you give us an idea of how you decided to organize the book?
To start first, there's sort of the making post-Soviet counterpublics chapter is the second chapter. It's preceded by a sort of prehistory of the movement in specifically kind of a study of Edward Limonov and his literary and public trajectory before the end of the Soviet Union. I won't go too much into detail, but Limonov was a very different character before becoming the kind of leader of the National Bolshevik Party. He became famous for this he was an underground poet. He became famous for this scandalous and very kind of raw narrative, semi-fictional biography that was It's Me, Eddie. And he was fascinated with actually leftist culture, countercultures of various kind, punk cultures. And so in a sense, he was the guy that brought back the aesthetics of Western countercultures in general and New York countercultures in particular. So the CBGB was the club where he hung out famously, was friend with various members of the Ramones. So that was kind of the punk side of the And so going back to the 1990s, since it's kind of quite a big period to cover it, so the organization of the chapters start with this moment in the sense of this way, this kind of sort of some of the influences that Limonov had in terms of countercultures. Again, William Burroughs, Pier Paolo Pasolini, among others, and say Dugin, who was a kind of right-wing conservative thinker, who also kind of liked to appropriate critical theorists such as the situationist Guy Debord and others, with sort of a criticism of postmodernism, but it's kind of a sort of strange hate-love relationship. And as you mentioned, the kind of the newspaper Le Monde is kind of the center of this aesthetics regarding the NBP, and especially the early period of the NBP. And it is kind of a newspaper that kind of started this movement from an aesthetical point of view, and through kind of the circulation of this newspaper, kind of created to an extent by eliciting a response from young people throughout Russia in the 1990s, created kind of this community and the culture of this community. And it did mix very many kind of not mutually incompatible things, such as the aesthetics of the Russian avant-gardes, socialist realism, totalitarianism, futurism, but both kind of the Italian futurism, which was appropriated by the fascists, and the Russian futurism, which became kind of the aesthetics of the 1920s and early Soviet period, with, again, punk counterculture of the 1970s in Europe as a kind of reinvented forms. And so the kind of the structure of the chapters, so Limonka was kind of an important element in terms of structuring my own narrative, in the sense that it was this kind of collective endeavor and sort of collective medium of expression. And in part, the rest of the narrative was also affected or kind of conditioned by my own kind of sort of ethnographic field work and research. So the discussions and conversations with the informants that I had, political activists, writers, artists that were involved with the movements at one moment or the other, kind of led a little bit in my narrative also, kind of in addition to the sort of chronology of what happened.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. Yeah. And I wonder, you know, without asking you to divulge your sources, I think you do a really good job getting into the ethnographic research. Could you explain maybe for our listeners what kind of method you had in talking to people and what kind of questions you had of them? You know, you mentioned this Eurasianist salon in your acknowledgments, and I would guess that you didn't just walk up to people and start asking them, what do you think of Dugin, or, you know, what do you think of Limonov or Sorokin or Pelevin or anything, that you actually had to, in some ways, have access to this underground world. So I'm particularly, you know, curious, after having read Alexei Yurchak and others, and the whole idea of living vnie, living outside, how you got into that world. So what was it, aside from just reading reading Limonov or reading the journals?
Mm-hmm. You mean into the world of counterculture and national Bolshevism?
Yeah, so. I mean, obviously you've got, you know, anarchists and punks on the left who are sort of anti-establishment, and then you have, as you introduce later in the book, the conservative postmodernists and ultra-nationalists on the right. Mm-hmm. So, and sometimes, you know, they're engaging in this in the same krizhok. I mean, what is it in the same circle? So what is it that gets you into this world? How did you go about doing that research?
Yeah. Thank you for your question. This is very interesting, and perhaps the one of the most exciting aspects of that for me of writing the book and researching the book. So one premise for your listeners should be that, again, the kind of distinction between the NBP, which existed as this countercultural movement in the 1990s, and the NBP of the 2000s versus the Alexander Dugin's Eurasia movement. So the NBP became two very different things in the 2000s. The Natsboli of Eduard Limonov, there was kind of a schism between Limonov and Dugin. And after sort of Putin's rise to power, Limonov and the Natsboli, because Limonov wanted the party to remain a quintessentially revolutionary party, they decided to kind of align themselves more or less with the liberal or generally the opposition against Putin. And they were a little bit of a street avant-garde of the opposition against Putin in the 2000s, whereas Dugin kind of gathered a smaller group of people coming, or schismatics, we might say, coming from the National Bolshevik Party, and he founded this Eurasia movement, which was quite the opposite. It was a staunchly imperialist supporter of Putin's regime. So starting from this premise, the ethnographic part and sort of how I went about meeting and talking and discussing some of these things with my informants, some of whom remain anonymous, sort of in the tradition of anthropology and cultural anthropology. In the book, they remain anonymous. Others who are kind of more public figures, so it would be kind of very difficult to make them, to protect their anonymity. They are actually named. But the vast majority, as you said, they're anonymous, and kind of the different ways, there are different ways I went about meeting them, depending on kind of the type of people they were. In this, and they were kind of very different kind of people. So in the case of the, so let's say, starting with the early NBP, so to speak, the way the kind of interaction was a little bit different with the older generation of Nutsboli, many of whom had left the party and that pursued different kinds of sort of intellectual, editorial, or academic careers. And with them, it was a kind of the easiest or the most kind of predictable type of interaction, in the sense that I would just get in touch with them on Facebook or email, or I would try to find their contacts and meet with them for a sort of so-called semi-structured interview, right? Start with a sort of set of questions and then go about sort of possible tangents, depending on what their answer would bring, where their answers would bring us. And in terms of finding the informants themselves, beyond the people who are kind of more visible and more kind of public figures, so in part I was doing what social scientists call the so-called snowball sampling, right? So at the end of my first interview, I would ask who are two or three people, I think, as you are doing.
Yeah, as exactly I'll do at the end of the podcast. We'll do a snowball together, Fabrizio.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a similar system. Right. And so who do you think I should talk to? And as some of the, at some point, so as some of the, some anthropologists I was kind of collaborating and in a dialogue with kind of taught me, and then I could verify in the field, at some point, you realize that you're going in the right direction if after interviewing or talking with several people, the people that are suggested start overlapping. In that case, you realize that you're kind of looking at the same network, right? So that's and so that was the one kind of interaction. The other one with the present activists with who were very sort of current activists who at that point were supporting Russia's annexation of Crimea. This was 2015 when I was doing my field work. Some of them were actually fighting as volunteers in Eastern Ukraine. So this was a kind of a very like less bourgeois type of interaction in the sense that I called, I asked to talk to someone, and then I kind of started attending some of their meetings and some of their more informal gatherings and marches and protests. So that was more of a participant observations in the sense that, of course, with this type of activists, I could not just turn on the voice recorder because that would have killed them.
Exactly. And that was kind of my next question, because I really want to ask about the gender dynamics, not only of the National Bolshevik Party, the NBP, but this place of eroticism and death and sexuality and experimentalism. I mean, you describe them as a counterculture in the book and their bohemianism especially, but it strikes me that the National Bolshevik Party is such a male-dominated organization. Could you give us a kind of general sense of this? Because there are women involved in it, but their gender roles become pretty conservative. Or correct me if I'm wrong. Correct me if I'm wrong with that.
Well, so it is a very also very interesting question that of gender, in the sense that. So I should add in terms of the interaction with my informants, I was going to add in terms of this Eurasianist salon that you mentioned, that was something a little different. For Eurasianists and Dugins who are very kind of close to the government right now, I was kind of trying to find possible connections in terms of people who could introduce me, in the sense that the circles were much kind of more kind of closer and more closed, sorry, and more secretive, right? So that's just a little digression. But going back to the gender question, yes, definitely, sort of, there was a kind of strong macho masculinist element in the National Bolshevik Party because of Limonov's kind of macho nationalist turn and fascination with war in the 1990s. And this is true. I mean, this kind of the NBP shared with nationalist movements in general, and also with the punk movement, right? That has always been quite male dominated in very many different places. At the same time, Limonov, and I should get to this important aspect, became before going back to Russia in the 1990s as an emigre underground writer and poet, became famous for describing again for the scandal that he produced in the Russian emigre community in the United States by describing in his book "It's Me, Eddie" his homosexual experiences, mostly with African American men, but sort of quite explicit homosexual scenes, graphic descriptions of homosexual relationships. So, and of course, Limonov at that point, the "It's Me, Eddie" in the 1990s had sold almost a million copies. Limonov became a celebrity because of this, and of course, so there was a strong contradiction in the sense of this. On the one hand, this masculinist attitude to politics and life, this kind of very warlike and military-like approach to gender roles. And on the other hand, there were aspects of the movement that kind of allowed for a certain kind of the transgression of gender roles, in part because of Limonov's interest self-presentation. Another person who was very close to Limonov when he came back to Russia, and who was before kind of emigrating to the United States, one of the main figure behind the National Bolshevik Party at the very beginning, was Yaroslav Magutin, who was he's a very famous kind of gay activist and art performer in New York now. He was at the time. So there was kind of a certain room for ambiguity in that sense. And the last thing that I should add, and there are, so this thing, it's very complex, nuanced, and very complicated. So I hope I do try to kind of clarify or disentangle some of these contradictions in some parts of my book. But another aspect in terms of the everyday life of the movement is that even if the NBP at various points had this kind of strong explicit declaration of masculinity and at times even traditional gender roles, some of my, and it was mostly male, some of my in terms of constituency and participants in the movement, some of my informants, in particular the female informants, were noticed how the NBP was famous among the nationalist movements, who are all very male dominated, for being quite a little bit of an exception in the sense that they had many more women than other nationalist movements, right? So they, because of this kind of artistic creative side of it, it was more sort of accepting, or it kind of drew more women than other movement. But although I should kind of
I sort of want to pick up on that, Fabrizio, because in your later chapters, especially when you then get into the commentaries about performativity and especially protest, the nature of protest, this is such a huge question going through the mid-2010s up to the very present with Navalny. I mean, so many have used the label fascist to describe Dugin. I wonder if you think that's correct. Others have made accusations against Limonov, the late Limonov, now for his childishness or just gestural forms of performative protest, which don't quite translate into civic activism, you know, the sort of politics of despair thesis. So, you know, I'm particularly interested in how you connect this performative politics to aesthetics. And if, let's say, in the age of of Pussy Riot and Navalny and beyond, it is actually more than just a graphomania, right? I mean, writing the 55 books that Dugin has in his official kind of way. My question is to get you sort of to connect the aesthetics to the politics, and especially in this performative scene in Moscow and beyond. How do you understand that problem?
Yes. So in parts of my book, I actually, and sort of some of the chapters, I kind of trace a certain connection between the performativity of the NBP essay and the performativity of such art, political art groups as the group Vajna or War, which was kind of the predecessors of Pussy Riot, in the sense both of their methods of protests and the type of kind of structure of the movement, in the sense that Vajna also had a little bit kind of this, well, radical anarchist, but also almost military-like structure and organization. And both in terms of the kind of inspiration, in the sense that many members of the group, that they talked about Limonov, they talked about Denats Boli, and they talked about their desire of kind of truly bringing the art into the streets and truly be kind of like a radical political activist and not just an art performer. And in terms of gender, one aspect that is interesting is that Nadia Talakonnikova and other members of Vajna, who then became sort of started their own group with Pussy Riot, in fact, they kind of started something new, in part because of the fact that Vajna was, in that sense, in a way similar to the MBP, a very male-dominated kind of masculinist, in part sexist movement. At least that's what they claimed. And so Pussy Riot, as a feminist art performance group, kind of continued the legacy of Vajna, but with this more feminist and kind of gender-oriented direction. So the other question is that of performativity, that maybe I leave on the side for a second, because there's the question of Stjob and living beyond.
Yeah.
And maybe we should keep that.
We can come back to that. Separate.
And in terms of fascism, there's no doubt that Limonov and Dugin, even more, they flirted with the fascist aesthetics, fascist ideas, or totalitarian ideas of various kinds. So I have no kind of doubts about that, or no resistance to the use of that sort of, or to the sort of acknowledging that aspect of this of this kind of performativity. What I have some resistance to is the use of the label fascism within political or critical theory or the political science. So in a sort of academic environment, in the sense that as many have kind of proven and discussed publicly, among them, say, Madeleine Laruelle, who's also a specialist on Russian nationalism, the term fascism in an academic environment is very loaded, and so should be used in a kind of more specific way, because otherwise it risks to be quite ambiguous. So to give you an example, very concrete example of this, you might be familiar with the pro-government movement Nashi, right? That was this pro-Putin movement that was organized by the Putin's administration, that was accused of horrible violence and persecution. And it was founded as an anti-fascist movement in the kind of tradition of the patriotic war and the struggle against fascism of the Soviet Union, was also accused of being fascist itself. Nashi were called Nashisti, right? And So it was this anti-fascist movement in the country. I think generally in various political contexts, one studies these fringe movements, it can be a very ambiguous movement in kind of term, the term fascism itself. I mean, and in the case of Russia, even more so, in the sense that accusers of fascism are kind of thrown back and forth as mostly a way to discredit any political opponent. And so they end up being quite not effective in terms of sort of scholarship. That's my main.
Yeah. And could you talk a bit about the aesthetics? Because, I mean, I find it fascinating how you bring your own sort of Italian background, if I might say so, into an understanding of the avant-garde and futurism here. You know, I think of older works like Renata Pajoli, but certainly you bring in a whole lot of Yuri Lotman and Ushakin and talking about the semiotics of this. I wonder if I might ask this as a question of you, Fabrizio. There seems to be a world of cultural critique and cultural theory that political scientists and those who are readily attaching the word or the label fascism are not quite understanding, or perhaps not quite conceptualizing. And, you know, I wonder if you could get into that, because it seems like a greater problem, this condition of performativity and postmodernity. And maybe, you know, in you describe this in talking about the conservative bohemia in this wonderful chapter, if you could get into the aesthetics. So, I mean, how do you see this as a particular moment in the 2010s and a critique of neoliberalism or in a particular, let's say, cultural field of neoliberalism, in which these writers and these intellectuals and artists and university students who are elitist but playing Gopniki. I mean, what? How do you see that particular aesthetic challenge?
Yeah, that's a good question. And yes, sometimes this is kind of in a way, this is the proof that kind of looking at culture and having a grounded approach to contemporary politics and societies in Russia and other countries can be a very effective way to look at kind of broad political processes, in the sense that it allows one to see and understand some of the cultural and almost linguistic nuances, right? Because some kind of the linguistic and cultural differences can actually bring a certain kind of misunderstandings, right? In terms of looking at politics in a beyond culture and beyond language. And in terms of the aesthetics, yes. To really over kind of simplify one of the points, if one looks, say, at Limonka in the sense of this kind of early period of the 1990s, there is an aesthetic that is the aesthetic of the avant-garde in the sense of sort of kind of the Rodchenko photo collage, but also, of course, in the most provocative manner, this symbol that the NBP had, which was this hammer and sickle, black hammer and sickle within a kind of white circle and on a red background, that was a hammer and sickle that reminded one of a swastika, right? So there was this immediate allusion that was quite shocking for anyone, sort of for the general public in Russia. And so if one looks at sort of oversimplified interpretation of this, is that in a world where in the 1990s, where sort of liberalism and Western democracy were kind of used as a sort of accepted truth, but especially that, of course, liberalism and Western democracy in a very sort of superficial manner, in the sense that the label was used to kind of justify the worst kinds of corruption or sort of social inequality and lawlessness of the 90s, in the sense of sort of widespread criminality. So for them, that sort of the use of these very shocking, radical art forms and sort of aesthetic forms was a way to kind of do the opposite of what the mainstream media or mainstream public culture was imposing. That is the idea that that kind of the Soviet Union, those 70 years of the Soviet history were kind of a strange mistake or a stain in kind of a Russian identity. And instead of accepting this idea of an end of history, end of ideology, and the fact that sort of the market, right, or consumerism should be a kind of complete and total explanation for everything beyond and outside of ideology, these people, the Natsvoli, took symbols that were hyper-ideological, right, an excess of ideology, as a response and rejection to this kind of denial and negation of ideology itself that was typical of the first post-Soviet period, if I can.
Yeah. And my last question for you before we get into our snowball and you suggesting some other people to read, including literature scholars, you know, I'm really intrigued by Elliot Borenstein's point in Men Without Women. And he makes this point about the coexistence of bohemianism and experimentation, and especially in gender and sexuality, with a sort of idealization of macho and masculinity and comradeship. And I wonder, you know, if I could ask you this as how you see Russian protests now. Do these communities of let's say aesthetic or aestheticized political protesters seem to be inclusive? Do they seem to be welcoming of non-Russians, or how do you understand this particular problem now in 2021 on the Russian literary and artistic scene? Is it just a sort of performance, let's say, at the moment when a person is insisting on a quest for authenticity during a university experience, or does it extend to something beyond that in the world of protest and nationalism?
Well, so I would say that it depends. So there is, in terms of the gender and masculinity aspect of this, I think that the example of Borenstein that you bring up in terms of the early Soviet period is very fitting, in the sense that this was also interesting. So that this was kind of not completely, that of the NBP was not completely an anomaly, in the sense that the early Soviet moment was a moment of great sort of, in part, sexual liberation, sexual experimentation, very progressive in certain aspects, family policies, and as many such as Borenstein and Erik Nyman proved also very macho and very anti-feminist and anti-femininity, right, in the sense of creating this
right
brotherhood of men. And so that's kind of a good example that applies to the contemporary moment, in the sense that as other sort of scholars have proven, there is a kind of also a competition and a use of sort of hyper-masculinity, both among sort of the anti-government protesters, and even the liberal protesters and the government. In terms of the type of inclusivity and sort of nationalist temperaments in the movement, it is something that so, and in that sense, that reflects, is kind of like a bigger version of the NVP, in the sense that the movement, the protest movement, is ideologically very diverse, right? So it's anything that is against Putin, and it includes the left, the right, feminist, nationalist, ethno-nationalist, imperialist forces, as it did in 2011, 2012. And in this sense, so that and in this sense, I think that's why I think that the NBP had also a very kind of strong influence on the contemporary moment, in the sense that the NBP was a platform, right, that accepted everything with this idea of combining radical left and radical right, and very much with anything that is radical or revolutionary ideology, or even just ideology, the result of this is that it was very much kind of a cultural, political laboratory or platform where people that were very different and had very different convictions coexisted. So skinheads and anarchists, communists and fascists, and so on and so forth, right? And conservatives and hyper-progressives, and so on and so forth. And in a sense, in a more mass scale, I think that the movements today, the sort of the protest movements, the waves of protest movements that that appear periodically in Russia against the government today, also they reflect a similar diversity. So it's very difficult to have a sort of definitive definition of these movements ideologically or in terms of sort of social policies, in the sense that they all accept pretty much everything and this coexists. And so and the positive aspect of this is that it is a kind of, right, a social and experiment and a political experiment in the sense that both the MBP on a smaller scale, more avant-garde sort of pioneering scale, the way they were kind of testing new forms of public culture, new forms of political culture in an interesting manner, as the as many of these kind of mass movements are today. The negative aspect that was kind of the classic criticism that was raised against the MBP and other kind of performative or aesthetic forms of protest is that they do not have a sort of ideological or political direction, and because of that, they're not really effective in terms of institutional politics and sort of change in terms of right, state and government institutions. Right.
Yeah. So it sounds like a lot, Fabrizio, like the accusations that were leveled at the Occupy movement, right? That it was an organization without a head, or that it was an ideological movement without an ideology. Yeah, I'm really interested in that. I'm also interested to see who is still reading Limonov now after his death, and Dugin. I mean, Dugin is Grafomanstvo incarnate. I don't know how many novels he has now, or I mean, 55, 56, I mean, and counting. So it's an interesting question for me, studying Ukrainian literature and culture, thinking about when these aesthetics function and when they sort of lose their momentum. So my final, you know, sort of setup for you, since we want to talk snowballs, is if you could recommend two or three other people, perhaps in your field for our listeners here at New Books Network and New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies, and then give us an idea, if you can, about your current research interests and projects.
Yes, I would be happy to do that. So I'm thinking in terms of people working in my field and in the field of political activism and culture today, and post-Soviet political activism and culture more generally. One is a cultural anthropologist. Her name is Julie Hammond. I don't know if you've heard of her, but she has a book on called Youth Politics. And it's youth politics in Putin's Russia, producing patriots and entrepreneurs. It's from 2015, and it analyzes actually with some ethnographic fieldwork. It analyzes the movement Nashi, the sort of the pro-government movement Nashi. So that's a very interesting way to look at very less known.
I don't know that. Thank you. Yeah, great.
So that's one. The other one, I would say, Marlène Laruelle, who's at George Washington University. She's very prolific and has a book that came out, I believe, just 2 years ago. The title is Russian Nationalism, Imaginaries, Doctrines, and Political Battlefields. And she's a political scientist and very up to date on sort of so many sort of movements and ideologies that emerged in the nationalist and conservative camps in the past few years. So that's an interesting book as well. And another, the third, is a friend and colleague who has been working on leftist poetry and sort of leftist literature more generally. And her name is Marietta Božović. And she has, this book is not out yet, but she has been working on it for several years. So it should be coming out soon. And again, it's she works mostly on sort of youth counterculture, and in, especially in this aspect of kind of leftist counterculture and poetry in the last 15 to 20 years.
Excellent. And just the 1 minute or one and a half, what are you working on now?
Well, so the main project that I would like to sort of mention is actually a collective project. So it could be in between snowball sampling, in the sense that there are other people involved that are also working on contemporary and post-Soviet culture and politics. And it's a digital humanities project that was awarded a 5-year NEH grant.
Andrew Jenko and company, right? And,
no,
and Natalia Yeremeyeva, yes?
No, this is another one.
Oh, another one. Okay, tell me. Sorry, go ahead. Sorry to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, it's fine. It's called Post-Soviet Media in the 90s. And the PI, principal investigator, is Maya Vinokur from NYU. And the idea is to create a digital archive. And it's about 6 or 7 of us involved. And it's going to be a digital archive of the 1990s, so the transfer focusing on media and various kinds of media, so television, newspapers, radio, print, and so on and so forth. All sort of online digital archive. It's kind of a long-term project. There will be an edited collection. There are various people involved. I won't name them all, but you can check them out. This is kind of I think it's going to be a very interesting project and kind of a way of discovering new materials and kind of aspects of contemporary Russian history that are less known. Right?
What's that? I'm sorry.
What was the project that you mentioned?
This is the project, just to mention, to plug it here, in New Books. It's the project with Andrew Jenko and the DH people. So Katya Bowers, who's in Grunwald, I believe Jesse Labau, Marietta Bojevich is involved in it at Yale, Natalia Yeremeyeva at Princeton. So I'm just like really fascinated now because there's more than one Russian digital humanities project with funding. So that's awesome. Yeah,
but I think that if I'm not mistaken, that their project is more focused on the Soviet period.
Yes,
and Soviet,
that's right. Yeah. That's right.
Right.
We're almost out of time, so I just wanted to make sure we have that and you, and that I thank you for joining us here to talk about your book. Are you working just very quickly, 30-second on something else? May I ask?
Yes, I'm working on this right now and an article for a cluster on geopolitical imagination in Russian fiction and beyond, and I'm writing my own article is about Pavel Krusanov, who's a Petersburg postmodern imperialist writer and the leader of the Petersburg fundamentalists or neo-fundamentalists that also produced some scandals with their manifestos in the early to mid 2000s. So that's the main, the sort of short term, and in the long term, the other sort of long project is about New Realism and Zakhar Prilepin, who was also coming out of the NBP, another sort of writers that, but that's more of a long-term project for my second book.
Yeah, fantastic, Fabrizio Fenghi. I really want to thank you for joining us here and talking about your book here on New Books Network. The new book is called It Will Be Fun and Terrifying, Nationalism and Protest in Post-Soviet Russia, All the More Urgent Right Now at This Very Moment, published by University of Wisconsin Press in 2020. Congratulations on the book. It was a pleasure to have you here on the New Books Network podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here. Come again. Thanks a lot for joining us.